Daniel chapter 2, verses 46 through 49. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. The king answered Daniel and said, "Truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Also, Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever. Have you ever considered how pervasive the argument that we have to leave our religion out of our public life is, that it's something that we should not bring in with us? We are told again and again that in the workplace, in politics, in school, even in social life, you know, the things that you're never supposed to discuss at the dinner table, two amongst them are politics and religion, supposedly. These are things that we're not supposed to discuss because it irritates the world and it'll get in the way of us doing what we have to. Well, one of the reasons that we're told that we must not allow our religion to come with us into the workplace, for instance, is that we will never be able to get ahead if we do. That somehow it will stifle our ability to succeed in this world, that it's going to work against us. We'll miss out on many temporal benefits. For instance, I remember once in a company that I worked in Washington, D.C., being told point blank by one of my managers that if I continue to be so open about my faith, about my Christianity, that my career with that company was going nowhere. As it happened, I changed jobs and got a much better one a few months later, but That was the all-pervasive air there. You were supposed to leave your religion at the door. Now, there was no sign telling us that, but there was this oppressive atmosphere that if you were a Bible-believing Christian, your thoughts were not welcome on any given subject. We are told again and again, and I'm sure that, brothers and sisters, you probably experienced this in your workplace, even in the army, that you have to compromise on your faith. Compromise, compromise, compromise. Told things like, "Oh, everyone around here uses that kind of language." Or, "We expect our people to work hard and play hard, too. Everyone has to work Sundays. Everyone fudges the numbers a little." You have to stretch the truth a little to make a sale. And you want to be a team player, don't you? Get on board. Get with the program. We're told in so many different ways, you have to compromise here. You have to compromise there. When you add it all together, you have to compromise everywhere. Until, if you do, a man or a woman who professes to be a believer in Jesus Christ ends up sounding and acting exactly like their unbelieving co-workers. That's a very sad state of affairs when you can't tell in the workplace who's a believer and who's not. Now, I know from experience how difficult that is, going through that constant pressure. And we may feel like we're the first people to go through that. We look at our time and we say, "It's never been like this." We say that so many times, but if we look back in history, yeah, it has. It has been like this. The pressure to compromise your faith in the public square is nothing new. I mean, I'm sure as soon as Daniel got to Babylon, for instance, as soon as he was brought there in exile, he and his friends, they were immediately under pressure to put aside their allegiance to Yahweh and just kind of fit in to, if I can put it this way, the corporate culture of the Babylonian wise men. Just fit in. It'll go well with you. Just follow the track. And adding to the pressure to do that was the fact that so many of their fellow exiles, so many of their fellow Judites had done exactly the same thing. I mean, think about it. You had the exiled king of Judah, supposedly the leader, the shepherd of the nation. And he's doing exactly that. He's gone along to get along. He didn't raise so much as a peep about eating the king's delicacies at his table. Did you think about that? It was only Daniel and his friends who did. They were the ones who created a stink. But brothers and sisters, from the very beginning, Daniel and his friends are determined not to compromise their faith. They're determined not to go along to get along if it means setting Yahweh in a secondary role, setting his commands aside, becoming just like the Babylonians. Daniel, we read, you remember, in chapter 1, determined not to defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacies. And contrary to what we are told again and again would happen, that determination to remain true to his faith, even in public, was not his undoing. As a matter of fact, it is what made him in so many different senses. I hope you realize that Daniel and his companions, if they had followed the worldly wise advice to leave their religion at the door, that this book would have ended at chapter 2. And then all the wise men were killed. The end. Close the book. That would have been the end of Daniel. In fact, we wouldn't have Daniel because he wouldn't have survived to write it. Brothers and sisters, it was in fact his very open faith in God and God's faithfulness to him that was what enabled them to succeed. What meant that he wasn't destroyed and in fact was advanced beyond all expectation. In one chapter, we see Daniel going from lowliest of the junior wise men, if I can put it that way, to a ruler of Babylon. One giant leap. And what allowed him to do that? A steadfast faith in God and God's faithfulness to him. And in that respect, of course, Daniel's story should remind you of the story of Joseph. You remember Joseph is taken to Egypt as a slave. He takes a stand for righteousness in Potiphar's house. And as a result, he's cast into prison. And he languishes there for many years. And he begins to think that he's been forgotten. But the Lord hasn't forgotten him. And he hasn't forgotten that he is his faithful servant. And so Joseph one day is brought into the presence of the king because the butler and the baker finally remember there was, well, actually it was the baker, of course, lost his head. But the butler remembers that there was a man in prison who knew how to interpret dreams, who seemed to have an avenue to God that nobody else did. And Joseph is exalted in a moment to the second position in Egypt. He becomes second only to Pharaoh. Now, Daniel's trust in God, we see here, is more than vindicated. And that, I've got to tell you, friends, has been my own experience, uniformly in this life. Contrary to what the world expects, it is the men and women who don't compromise their faith. It's the men and women who stand when everything is telling them, compromise, compromise, who are blessed. And on the other hand, the people who do sow the seeds of compromise end up reaping a very, very bitter harvest. Now, we'll talk more about that in a moment, but first, I want to make a few observations about the text itself, get down into it. Now, after Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar what his dream was, and then he interprets it, tells him what it meant, Nebuchadnezzar falls to the ground before him. And I hope you see how amazing that is. Here we have the most powerful ruler on earth, bowing down, falling down before one of his own captives. And Nebuchadnezzar does this because he is awestruck by this display of the power of God. Totally awestruck. I mean, think about it. Why is he awestruck by the power of God? Daniel's told him his dream, and Daniel's interpreted it. Well, Nebuchadnezzar could command armies. Nebuchadnezzar could break down city walls, and he could command that they be built up again. Yeah, he has tremendous temporal power, greater than most men on earth will ever have. But with all of that power at his command, he did not have the ability to know the thoughts of men's hearts. And so, you imagine it, he has a court packed full of people. He is surrounded, literally, night and day by people all the time. And yet, he never could really know who he could trust, because he couldn't know their hearts. Wise and powerful men in every age have struggled with that. I don't know what they're thinking. I can guess, but I really don't know. I can't see inside of them. Also, with all of that power over men and their faiths, he couldn't tell what was going to happen the next day. Every night, Nebuchadnezzar went to bed with no knowledge of what the next day would bring. And so, although he has all of this power in his hands, he sees that in so many ways, he's as defenseless as any other man. He's as powerless as any other man. But there is one who did know those things, who was far more powerful than any man, and who could know these things. No man but God knew these things, and that's what Daniel told him. There is no wise man on earth, O king, who can tell you your dream, but there is a God in heaven who is a revealer of secrets, who knows all of these things. And that is why when Nebuchadnezzar sees a display of such power, he falls down before the messenger. Now, obviously a question comes up in the text immediately. If you haven't already thought of it, I'm sure you have. You have to ask yourself, is Nebuchadnezzar worshiping Daniel at this point? Or is he doing something more like Alexander the Great did? When Alexander the Great came to Jerusalem, he bowed down to the earth before the high priest, before he entered into the city. And he explained to his aides, when they asked him, "What are you doing? You're the great Alexander. You've conquered most of the known world. Why are you doing this?" Alexander said, "I do not worship the high priest, but the God with whose high priesthood he has been honored." Now, that could be one split on that issue. I tend personally to think that Nebuchadnezzar really did mean to offer worship to Daniel, but that Daniel reacted to that attempt to worship him in a way similar to the way that Peter reacted to Cornelius' attempt to worship him. You remember in Acts 10:26, when Cornelius meets with Peter, he immediately falls on the ground before him, and Peter says to him, "Stand up. I myself am also a man." That's what the messengers of God, even an angel does that with John in Revelation, you remember. I'm a creature as well. You're not supposed to worship any creature. Don't give your worship to man. Give your worship to God. He alone is worthy of it. And that's why it's so very important, if I can do a brief aside, when the apostles fall down before Jesus, he doesn't say to them, "Stand up." Now, Jesus knew as well as Peter that worship was only to be given to God. But that leaves us with the conclusion. Who alone is worthy of worship? God is. Why did Jesus not stop them from worshiping him? Because he is God. Don't believe what the Jehovah's Witnesses tell you at their doorstep. In fact, take them to those difficult passages. Why are they falling down? Why is Thomas worshiping him here? Ask those questions. But anyway, what happened, I think, is that on three occasions we saw Daniel making it clear that it was not Daniel who had insight into the king's dreams. It was not Daniel who knew these things. It was not Daniel who had revealed this to the king. He even points out to him, "But as for me, the secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living." Not at all. And I believe that Daniel, once again, when that happened, said that he was not the one worthy of worship and offerings, but that he was only the messenger of the God who was in heaven. Now, it doesn't say that in our text, but in support of that idea, if you look at verse 47, it says that the king, and in the text it's Anad, which means to answer. The king Anad Daniel. This is, he replied to Daniel, or he answered Daniel. There's something spoken there that isn't written down. And you'll notice that after the king's praise is given to God, not Daniel. So I believe that although Daniel didn't write it, what he did was he said something to the king to the effect of, "Hey, don't worship me. I'm not the one worthy of your praise. I speak for God." That's it. So Nebuchadnezzar's praise of God in verse 47 is instructive, very instructive. Now clearly, Nebuchadnezzar doesn't become a worshiper of the only living God at this point. He really isn't. In fact, I don't have to guess at that. In the next chapter, he's setting up an idol and telling everybody in Babylon, "If you don't bow down before this idol that I've set up, you're all going to die." And this is going to bring a world of trouble to Daniel's three companions. But he's clearly still a polytheist. He's clearly still a pagan. He calls God the God of gods. In other words, your God, Daniel, is clearly the most powerful God. But I'm still going to worship my Babylonian gods as well. That's the position that Nebuchadnezzar's at this point. He also calls him the Lord of Kings. In short, and this is amazing too, Nebuchadnezzar is saying to Daniel, "Your God rules." If I can put it in the colloquial term, but in a sovereign sense, "Your God rules." Anyway. Clearly, Nebuchadnezzar believes that God is sovereign over all things, including future events. This God that Daniel worshipped, Nebuchadnezzar has seen, is the God who determines everything that will come to pass, who exercises dominion over the whole world, not just one tiny nation, but rather that this is the God who is ordaining everything that comes to pass, even in his own kingdom. And that is why he can tell that his plan is going to happen with certainty. That is how God knows it, because he is the one who decreed it. Now, again, this is just an aside, but I hope that everyone here is at least as convinced of the sovereignty of God as this pagan king was. Now, I hope you see that, because the only way that Daniel could predict with any certainty the succession of kingdoms, and we know, we have the benefit of hindsight, we know that everything came to pass, as Daniel said it would. But the only way that he could tell that these kingdoms were going to rise and fall exactly the way that they did, and that in the fullness of time, Jesus would come, he would establish this kingdom that had no end, The only way that that could happen was because God decreed that it should come to pass. He was the one who raised up those kingdoms. He was the one who cast them down. He was the one who, in the fullness of time, had ordered everything so that all was prepared for the birth of Jesus Christ as a babe in Bethlehem. If there really was such a thing as chance, if there really were these random molecules out there that were not under God's command, if, you know, every decision really was a nail biter, so to speak, then Babylon could have beaten Persia and not vice versa. Think about that. If there really was such a thing as chance, Alexander and the Romans, instead of preserving the Jews, could have destroyed their nation. They could have, in 1,000 different ways, have made it impossible for Jesus to be born at the appointed time, if chance really played a role. But there is really no such thing as luck or chance. So as Christians, I hope you're watching your speech in that respect. I mean, even as a Christian, I have to watch myself occasionally. You know, somebody will go off and do something, and you'll say, good luck. And then you'll think, wait a minute, there is no such thing as luck. It's better to say Godspeed, if you know, Godspeed you on your way in that. But all of these things came to pass, not because God foresaw them, but because God foreordained them. That is what Nebuchadnezzar saw. I hope you see that as well this morning. In any event, while Nebuchadnezzar no longer seeks to worship Daniel, he does promote Daniel to the very highest levels. He becomes ruler over the central province of the empire, the central dominion being Babylon, the richest portion. And he becomes the head of the king's wise men, which is ironic, but appropriate, because he's the only one who had the power to actually know what was going to come to pass. He was the only one who was gifted by God in that respect of all the wise men. All the other ones just knew the tricks of the trade, so to speak. They knew how to pontificate, how to speculate, how to read people so they could tell them what they wanted to hear. But it was the fact that they were ultimately blind as to what was really going to happen. And Nebuchadnezzar saw that. I can only speculate that this is where the God who reveals things, the God who is the revealer of secrets, has opened up to us what his plans are. And by knowing them, we may not infallibly know what's going to happen day after day after day, but we know what will happen in the end. We know where it's all going. And imagine how much more these wise men would have learned from Proverbs or Isaiah than they would have learning from the garbage that they've been reading for so long. Rodney Stortz, who is a commentator on these verses, believed that it was because Daniel, and this is speculation obviously, but that it was because Daniel changed the curriculum of the wise men, that hundreds of years later, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him, beginning of Matthew. I don't know that that's the truth, but you know, I'd like to think that he's right in guessing that. Anyway, Daniel doesn't forget his friends, obviously, after he's promoted. He is remembering them. He remembers the ones who prayed with and for him. And he has them promoted as well. And together they are going to do much good for their people in the Babylonian Empire. Now let me leave you with one great application from this text. And it is simply this. Brothers and sisters, never compromise your faith. And let me give you the reason for that. All right, I'm going to give you two reasons never to compromise your faith. One positive and one negative. Positively, it's this. It's because the promises of God are sure. Now, Daniel was submerged in a pagan culture, submerged in a culture even more pagan than yours, a workplace even more difficult than yours, as bad as yours is. But not that everybody's workplace is bad. I don't want you to come away thinking that. But, you know, as difficult as it is to be a consistent Christian where you are, it is nothing compared to what Daniel went through. But like Abraham, Daniel believed the promises of God. And that included the promise that someday a Redeemer would come out of Zion. Now, Daniel knew that God had said that someday he would send the Deliverer, the Messiah, into the world. And Daniel was holding on to that great and central promise, the promise of the coming seed, who way back in Genesis 3:15 we read would crush the head of the serpent. So Daniel knew that while his circumstances might look bad, ultimately, he knew the end from the beginning. He knew that the Lord would deliver his people. If he had looked at circumstances alone, he might be tempted to believe it was all over for God's visible church. I mean, things look pretty bleak. Israel had been destroyed. Judah had been destroyed as well. Jerusalem had been sacked. The people of God had been hauled off into exile, and there seemed to be no end to the power of Babylon. Had he been walking by sight, he would have compromised. But Daniel, who was familiar with the Word of God, knew from the book of Isaiah, which was written long before what had happened, that many things would happen. That he couldn't see, but he saw by faith. He knew, for instance, in advance, the exile would come. Anybody who'd studied Isaiah would know that. And it's not just in Isaiah, it's throughout the Bible, but I want to give you one book where these things are paramount. They're taught so explicitly that you can't miss them. Secondly, that Babylon would be destroyed, even though this empire seemed to be, you know, charging all over the place, destroying God's people, eating up kingdom after kingdom, that eventually this empire would be destroyed by Persia, and that the exile would end, and that Cyrus, the king of Persia, would pay to rebuild Jerusalem. Take a look sometime at Isaiah 44:28. The name of the king of Persia is mentioned explicitly. He even knew, and can you imagine those wise men trained by Daniel when Cyrus and the Persians come in? Wow, he was right. These books really do tell you what's going to happen. That's amazing. It's a shame that, you know, Daniel and the wise men know better than we do today. But anyway, the deliverer, the suffering servant, he knew he was coming because Isaiah 53 and Isaiah leading up to that made it absolutely explicit that this wonderful counselor, this Prince of Peace, would be born and that he would save his people from their sins. So he knew all of those things were coming. Now, if he had walked by sight, how would he have known these things? He would have looked around at his circumstances and said, this is pretty terrible. We've been praying for people in Vietnam. Can you imagine how the church felt after Saigon fell? After communism came in? After atheism became the enforced rule throughout the country? People would be tempted to despair if they didn't know that there was a God who is sovereign over all of the nations, all of the rulers, and who has said, darkness may come in for a while, but my light, my gospel will prevail. My Redeemer will come, and he will set all things aright. And therefore they hold on in the midst of persecution, in the midst of tribulation, knowing that the Lord has not forgotten them, has not forsaken them, and that he does, if I can use the cliche, have a wonderful plan, not just for their lives, but for all of his children and for all of his church, and that he is bringing it to pass. And so throughout his lifetime, the things he knew from the Word were confirmed. Daniel, and I hope you read the Word like this as well, that you read it to see your faith confirmed. Daniel read it, and he saw prophecy after prophecy, event after event confirmed, coming to pass. And that is why Daniel had no hesitation. After he had told the king what the dream meant, the great God has made this known to the king, what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. My God has revealed it. My God keeps all of his promises. It will come to pass. Although it seems impossible that Babylon, at the top of its game, would be cast down and Persia would come in just a few years later, I know it will happen. Because my God has never failed to keep a single one of his promises. And brothers and sisters, he won't in your lives as well. But I meet so many people who walk by circumstance, who look at the events around them and say, God can't, God can't, God can't. If God can cast down Babylon, he can't fix your life? You're too difficult for him? Since when? This is the God who orders empires, who raises them up and casts them down. And you saying, I have to compromise at work, Andy. I have no possibility of advancing in my trade, my given profession. Well, brothers and sisters, unless your given profession is explicitly sinful, I know that's a lie. Because I see this, and I know it from my own experience. And so Daniel and countless saints after him knew that God's promises were sure, that the kingdom would be established, someday it would fill the earth, and like Abraham, he saw the day of Christ, and he rejoiced, and as a result, he is able to stand firm. Now, he saw the kingdom afar off. The sad thing is, we as saints act like we're on less firm ground, and we see it in hindsight, after it's been established, after the church is growing, after, even though it is by schisms rent asunder, by heresies distressed, constantly oppressed on every hand, martyrs made every day. Did you know there were more Christian martyrs in the 20th century than any other preceding century? And yet the church continues. It continues. And we are able to stand on the rock, that Daniel saw filling the earth. How much surer should we be than Daniel when we have so much more knowledge, so much more fulfilled prophecy to look at? So positively, don't compromise your faith because the promises of God are sure. They are sure. Negatively, don't compromise because compromise has never led to anything good. We are sold a bill of goods by the devil again and again. He said, eat of the fruit and you'll be as God. And yet, were they? Not at all. They were miserable from that point onwards. We buy his bill of goods, though. We have a tendency to compromise our faith, a tendency to allow for false gods, a tendency to allow for abominable practices in our lives. But what Daniel knew is that those very habits are what put the people of God into exile in the first place. How would he gain from the very thing that God had punished? Had Daniel done it, had Daniel compromised, in a vain pursuit of worldly riches, he would have come to nothing. And I myself have seen many Christians do exactly that. They end up sacrificing precious things, lasting things, in pursuit of dust and fleeting glory. They sacrifice, for instance, a clear conscience. Do you know how precious that is? Not to be constantly worrying, not to be kept up at night, not to be afraid that somebody's going to be able to pick apart your web of lies. Somebody will know what you were doing, what you did, that your expense account was bogus, and just worrying, all of those things. And worse, knowing that there's a God who is watching over you when you did these things, and knowing that there's now a cloud between you and him, and feeling the weight of it pressing you down. You sacrifice that when you choose to compromise your faith. You sacrifice the ability also to be light and salt in a lost and dying world. And brothers and sisters, what more precious gift can you give to somebody than to tell them about your Savior Jesus Christ and to show them what a change Christ can make in a life? They don't believe the gospel far too often because they've never seen it. Do you know what I mean? They've never seen a consistent Christian. They've never seen a person who has really been changed. Too many people in this world just see naked hypocrisy. People who say they believe one thing, but then act just like it. In order to just fit in, we're seeking to just fit into the dog pack. And we sacrifice the ability when we do that to stand head and shoulders above it. Now you would be surprised, or you might be surprised, I hope not that surprised, to see how much more even pagans will respect a man or a woman or a child of consistent faith, of consistent virtue, who doesn't constantly compromise over compromisers, over people who just go with the flow. Now, they may think you're good fun if you are a compromiser, but they'll seldom respect somebody they know is just as compromised as themselves, especially if they affirm something totally different. Who respects a hypocrite after all? And brothers and sisters, that's all we are if we're compromising our faith. We're saying one thing and doing another. So if you are already compromising, stop. There is always time for the prodigal to return. If you haven't yet gotten started compromising, don't. And kids, this particularly applies to you. Especially the older ones who are getting to the point where you're going to begin going out into the work world, you're going to be leaving your family more often. You are going to have so many opportunities put before you. The world, in school particularly, in college especially, is going to say to you, compromise your faith. Do this thing. Just go along with us here. And then it'll say, go along with us here, and here, and here. And they'll be encouraging you to do things that the Bible specifically tells you not to do. And if you do them, you will end up walking down a very, very bitter path. Now, I know your parents don't want that for you. But most especially, the Lord doesn't want that for you. He will bless a decision to stand firm. And though you may be accused of not being as fun as others at times, ultimately you will be far happier than the people who are trying so hard to have so much fun. Now, some of you may be thinking, I'll lose all of this cool stuff. All of these, the bennies that I get for going along with the world, all of the temporal blessings, if I take a stand for Christ, if I put him ahead of everything else. I mean, we see, for instance, from chapter 1, Daniel lost the chance at eating the king's delicacies for many years. And instead, what did he eat? He ate common fare. He ate vegetables. He drank water. When all of his other compatriots who had compromised, what were they eating? They were eating the best food. They were eating four-star, five-star cuisine, drinking the best wine. And I'm not going to lie to you. Men and women have lost jobs and preferment for Christ. Many a minister has lost his position because he would not compromise, more than I can count. But remember, when you do compromise, what are you doing? You are sacrificing the world's, or rather, when you don't compromise, let me reverse that. When you don't compromise, you are sacrificing the world's treasure, yes. What are you gaining instead? You are obtaining eternal treasure. You are, let me put it this way, in a short summary, you are giving up what you cannot keep for something that you can never lose. There is nothing to be gained, therefore, that lasts through compromise. Don't do it. Stand for Christ, wherever you are, and never check your religion at the door. Let's go before the Lord, who never checks his faith. Gracious and holy God, we do thank you, O Lord, that even when we are faithless, yet you are faithful. You have been working out your purposes in this world. You are sovereign. And there is not one single promise you have not kept or will not keep ultimately. I thank you for that, O Lord, because it does give us the strength to walk by faith and not by sight. I do pray, O Lord, for the men and women here who are in the work world, who are constantly given opportunities to compromise their faith, to pretend that they aren't Christians. Oh, Lord, I pray that you would strengthen them, that you would put steel in their backbones, that you would allow them to stand for that which is right and true. I pray, oh, Lord, for those who have not yet entered the world in a real sense. I pray for our kids. I pray, oh, Lord, that you would safeguard them, that you would help us to raise them up to love you more than anything in the world, and to know, oh, Lord, that all of the beads and the baubles and the plastic devices that the world offers to them, all of these snares and traps, that none of them, oh, Lord, are worth anything at all, because they're all passing away. They're all fleeting. They're just dust. They're sand that slips through our fingers. But, O Lord, those who stand firm on the rock, who stand firm in Jesus Christ, who believe his gospel without wavering, they inherit an eternal treasure. Remind us to lay up our treasures in heaven and not on earth, where moth and thief destroy. O Lord, help us to walk by faith and not by sight. We pray this in Jesus' holy name. Amen.